Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Ms. Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
The whole thing is very mysterious, but this is what I know.
Authorities say the menacing letter received yesterday by a Vallejo newspaper was not sent by the infamous Zodiac killer. Betsy Gebhardt has details.
That Area 51, the secret Air Force base in Nevada, actually exists.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
Okay, welcome back to the House of Mystery here. We're on KKNW, 1150 AM, Seattle, and drive time. This is Al Warren, of course, and Kev Thompson's there.
Hey, Al.
Hey, so here we are. Now, we're going to get into this. We've been talking to some of the people about the Kurt Cobain suicide, death, murder, whatever, and there's so much going on with different shows and stuff. We're going to cover that a little bit from, and we're sort of going through people that were appearing on the documentary Soaked in Bleach, and it seems like we're getting quite a different story from a lot of people that were on that show compared to what they say live to us. So I find that interesting.
Well, you know, Al, what makes this case so different from any other, though? Why all the conspiracy over Kurt Cobain?
You know, I don't know. I think that he was really kind of a millennial icon. And as a lot of them do, he died early, you know, very young. Mm-hmm. And anybody that's popular, you know, look at JFK and look at it. I mean, when you die before your time, I sort of think that people dream about what could have been, and that's quite a thing. So I think that happens with him, and for some reason people really dislike Courtney Love, his wife. Well, for some reason, for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, I mean,
that's not hard to do.
We'll save that for the show.
Yeah, but that's not hard to do. But and for some reason, it's really kind of a too bad, because I think what they're doing is taking someone that's not popular and making them the evil person. And okay, so if he was murdered, let's say, she would have to do it, and it just sort of fills in the hole. So it's easier to put out a show saying that, and people that really like him, of course, can jump on that. But I only want to talk about conspiracy, as in when someone presents some evidence and then you find out that it's not as it is, they've created it, there's a reason. and right. we have to dismiss that because it's not real. So the big interview will be in September with the chief of police of Seattle. That's
wow.
I know, that's pretty exciting, actually. It is.
We only bring the best.
I hope I don't get arrested. well, you never know. You know, I might park wrong or do something. If I say the wrong thing, he might bust me. So, but, you know, well, that's okay, too. Nothing like being in prison with men. so now today we have Carol Chasky, PhD. I was going to call her doctor, but I wasn't sure.
That would be appropriate.
Well, yeah, but people think medical doctor right away, and it isn't necessarily that. Now, quite the credentials. Man, this is like a book of all of the accomplishments. It's pretty impressive. And Carol's on the line, so thank you for being here, Carol.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, welcome aboard.
This is, you've sure done a lot. It makes me feel like I've done nothing.
Well, nobody can see my gray hair. It's taken a while to do things.
Yeah, it takes a
while. And then there's much more to do, you know. There's just so much more to do.
Well, this is very interesting. So now, Institute for Linguistic Evidence. Well, I find this fascinating, this whole, you know, digital evidence investigations and all this stuff. How did you get started on this? Like, where did this come from for you?
Oh, okay. I was a professor at North Carolina State University in linguistics. I was really not happy in the academic world because I really like to do things that are very useful and, you know, have a direct service in society.
Oh, yeah.
And I just felt that, you know, teaching linguistics to English majors and engineering students, you know, really, really wasn't going to be my path in life, but I couldn't figure out what else to do.
Yeah.
And people were coming up with all kinds of suggestions for me, and none of them seemed right. So I did what anyone does when they're really faced with a wall. I just started to pray, you know, God, please show me some kind of path. And I got a call from a detective named W. Allison Blackman. He goes by Allison, his family name. Asking me if there was any way I could determine the authorship of suicide notes that were left on a home computer of three guys that lived together as roommates. So I said, well, do you have any ink? Do you have any paper? Do you have any handwriting? You know, thinking that he would probably go to the state crime lab. And he said, oh, I've already done that. I've gone to the state crime lab. And they said, you don't have ink, you don't have paper, you don't have handwriting. What do you want us to do? And he started asking around and found out that there was such a thing called linguistics.
Yes.
So he called up my department. Somebody sent him to me. And I said, if you're willing to work with me as an experiment, I have some ideas, but you have to recognize this is experimental, and he was fine with that because he was just a really good detective and a really good investigator. I analyzed the syntactic patterns of the three roommates, and by syntax I mean like the way we put our words into phrases and our phrases into sentences. So it's, if you can remember diagramming in middle school, it's kind of like that.
Oh, yeah.
And then I counted up things about those syntactic patterns, ran a very simple statistical test, and there was only 1 in 10,000 chance that the fella had written his own suicide notes. And there was a significant difference between the suicide notes and one of his roommates, but not the other roommate. So I said, I think this is the fella who wrote the suicide notes, because I can't get any significant difference between him and the suicide notes. And that's when they told me that he actually had access to all the legal drugs that were injected into the fellow who died. He was 6 weeks from his medical degree. He was known to be able to give medicine without waking people up. And he was tried. He was arrested and then went on trial. And on the witness stand, he admitted that he wrote the suicide notes.
Oh, wow.
So
would it be fair to say that it's not forensic psychology, but it's forensic linguistics?
Absolutely. You hit it on the head.
Yeah, where you don't analyze the handwriting, but you analyze the thought behind it and say that this mindset belongs to this person.
Yes. In fact, I don't analyze the handwriting, and I don't analyze the psychology of the person either. I don't say that the person is depressed because I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, so I can't really make that kind of an announcement. But what I can say is that the language, which is built in our minds first, you know, language just takes our thoughts and decodes them, you know, encodes them somehow. So I can say that those patterns either match or don't match some other document.
True. See, I work in law enforcement and report writing. And as a supervisor, I can look at a report and say, listen, you didn't write this report. You wrote it for your buddy. How did you know? Well, because the verbiage.
Yes. And because you're so familiar with those people. I mean, some of the things about language that I really love are how forgiving it is. For instance, you know how we can start a sentence, and if we really know somebody well, that person will finish it for us?
Ah, yes. Me and Al do that on air.
And so when you're reading those reports, you know the people so well that in a sense you hear them or you don't hear them. And when you don't hear them and it has, you know, their name on it, you think, wait a minute, something's fishy here.
Yeah.
And that's how language is. It's built so that we can communicate super, super fast with each other. And also kind of predict what's coming next. And syntax is really the glue that holds that together. But syntax also degrades in milliseconds. So, I mean, everybody's had the experience of, you know, like it's almost a joke in marriage counseling. You know, Bob, say exactly what Mary just said. You know, and he paraphrases it. Because
yeah.
We all paraphrase when we hear what somebody just said, and everybody goes, Bob, you didn't say exactly what she said. Because the syntax or the form of it, it degrades in milliseconds. I mean, it's lost. And so you just remember the meaning of it, and then you say the meaning in however you would say the meaning.
How do you find that the courts deal with this and admissibility and stuff? Is there any issues with that?
Oh, yes. I'm so glad you brought this up. Fortunately, the method that I've developed using these syntactic patterns has been very successful in being admitted into courts in the states and also at federal courts. But that's because we've been developing this method for years. I mean, started developing the method in 1994. And with developing it, we were really conscious of figuring out when is it wrong and what does it need in order to work well. So these days in American courts, judges typically go by what's known as the Daubert standard. And some of the things that Daubert standard wants are, what's your error rate? You know, how often is your method just wrong? Just because methods can be wrong. And are you following a standard operating procedure? So we have that for the syntactic author ID. There are other methods that are out there. There's a method called stylistics, and people call that by lots of different names. Sometimes they call it sociolinguistics. The people who use it keep changing the name of it, but it has actually had a very rough time being admitted as evidence, and either it's not admitted at all, where judges just say, no, you don't have an error rate, you don't have a standard operating procedure, we just can't really let you talk to a jury about this, or
right.
You can talk to the jury, but you can't state a conclusion about the authorship. That's a really weird thing for an expert to do.
Well, yeah.
How is that? I mean, I'm trying to wrap my mind around that. I mean, evidence is evidence, but simply because you don't have an A, B, C, D step, you know, to get to the, you know, this conclusion.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't get it.
You don't get it. What, that it should be not be allowed or what?
No, I believe it should be allowed.
Oh, okay.
But
okay,
everything has to be so cut and dried. You know,
absolutely.
You know, and it's just, you know, oh, it's frustrating.
Well, I agree with you that if you have a stepwise method and it's cut and dry and you know how accurate it is for that particular case, you know, then I think it should be admitted, and that's what we've done. We're very fortunate. The syntactic method I was just talking about has an accuracy rate of 95%. We range, obviously. You know, sometimes our accuracy rate for a case might be, you know, 83%. But we know for each case just how accurate it is because we first of all run it on the different suspects in the case and say, well, how accurately can I differentiate Kev and Al? How accurately can I differentiate Al and Carol? If I can't do a good job differentiating the known stuff, then, you know, who wants me to figure out where the unknown came from? So we've done all that work. And the other method I was talking about, the stylistics method, they just haven't done it. And a lot of it is because it's really, they can't do it. The stylistics method is so subjective that, I mean, they actually say, we don't know what we're going to find until we find it. You know, that's sort of like the whole thing that happened. You know, I'm thinking about like the O.J. Simpson case, you know. People found stuff that became important later.
Yeah, a day late and dollar short.
Yeah.
Now, would it be fair to say, though, for the sake of some of our law enforcement listeners, that what we're discussing here is the difference between scientific evidence and empirical evidence?
Well, I would say that scientific evidence is empirical, and I would say what we're talking about is the difference between scientific objective evidence and non-scientific subjective evidence. For instance, let's say that you have a suicide note, and instead of using the word and written out, A-N-D, the writer of the note used an ampersand, okay, or a plus sign. Well, in the stylistics method, the stylistics analyst might say, oh, that ampersand is significant, and I found it in this other document, so this suicide note must have been written by the person who wrote this other document. Now, of course, immediately you should be thinking things like, well, wow, you know, the ampersand's on the keyboard. Anybody could use that.
Yes.
Or, you know, I know people who use ampersands.
But why would they?
That doesn't necessarily mean they're the author of something. You know, in fact, anybody who uses the ampersands might have been the author of this document. So that's a little scary. And on the other hand, I've seen reports where the same stylistic analyst who says that ampersand is really crucial in one case, in another case will say, oh, no, that doesn't matter at all. That's not significant. That's why, that's what's scary about that method and why I believe the courts are right in not letting it in, because you never know what they're going to say is significant. And it's like they say, we never know until we find it. Well, science doesn't really operate like that. I mean, that would be like saying, we can't tell the temperature until we make up how to measure Fahrenheit.
How often are you, or do people leave suicide notes? Do we know that?
That's pretty rare, actually. Suicide notes, some people say about 10% of suicide notes. Other people say it could be as high as 25%.
Wow.
Yeah, so when you think about it, it's rare.
Huh. I always thought it would be more than that.
Exactly. Because you would want people to know, why did I do this?
I know. And I think for the survivors, this is one of the hardest things, is that for so many of them, you know, from 90 to 75% of them, they don't get that kind of closure.
Exactly. And here's why I'm surprised. If I was to commit suicide right this minute, I still love my family, I still love my friends, and I would want them to understand why I did this, because, you know, I'm depressed, I don't like my life, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't want you to go through life wondering, was it me, was it me? You know, you'd think that people would want that, but you say only 10% of people leave notes?
From 10 to 25%, yes. And,
wow.
And, you know, another amazing thing about it is that, well, first of all, suicide notes are rare, and then secondly, suicide notes are so variable, they're almost like human faces. They're so unique in terms of they just don't share a lot of features over and over. We, like, when normal people, you know, who are not suicidal, when we think about what would we say in a suicide note, that's very different than what real suicidal people write in their suicide notes.
Yeah. That
when I started doing this work.
Yeah. Would it also be fair to say, because I'm trying to reconcile what you said, would it also be fair then to say that usually suicide is not really well thought out? Like I wake up this morning, find out I lost my job, I'm going to end it. Mm-hmm. And I just don't have the time to write a note because it's an instantaneous decision.
Or impulsive.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think there are impulsive suicides, but one thing I've read in the literature that was very interesting to me is that, so, you know how it's always shocking when a person commits suicide? I mean, it's just always stunning to everybody around them. You know, I most people don't say, like, oh, yeah, I saw that coming. Instead, people feel like, wow, I thought he was getting better, you know, or I thought he was actually happier.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's because suicidologists theorize that there's this terrible period of tension when the person is deciding, you know, what do I want to do?
Well, that's
and
true.
And then once they make the decision, they actually do get happier because at least they know now.
They've resolved themselves to it.
Yes. They've got that resolution, that calmness. And so everybody around them mistakenly thinks that that resolution and calmness is the decision's been made, you know, the happy way, the non-suicide way, and actually it's been made the other way.
How often do you, now I'm going to tie this in, now fake notes, do you get fake suicide notes, and, you know, on all the TV shows, you know, they always have someone writing a fake note, you know, and killing someone.
Actually, that was my first case, as I described. My first case was a fake, they were fake suicide notes.
Right.
That the fellow wrote after he murdered his roommate. And he finally admitted on the witness stand, I did it to get the cops off my back. And, you know, it was already done, so that was the only thing I could do. And so that's how he handled it. Now, I have had cases where the police theorized that a suicide note was fake because they thought, like, a boyfriend had murdered his girlfriend. And when I did the analysis of this of the note, it was a real suicide note, not a phony suicide note. So I think that police officers have to think about it both ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, could this be a real one? Could it also be a phony one?
Right. And that's tough. When they're famous, I would imagine, like we're going to tie into Kurt Cobain, of course,
mm-hmm.
and
Courtney.
Courtney, yeah. And so being that they were both quite famous, and he ended up dead, mm-hmm. there's a lot of controversy over this. People that loved him and don't like her, and I noticed. You were in Soaked in Bleach as well in the documentary.
Yeah.
And they brought attention to me how you made some comments since then saying that they kind of manipulated what it is that you said in the show.
Yes.
So can you explain that to us? Like, what exactly is it that they changed?
Well, I have not seen the show, but everything I've read about it, and basically, I am presented as saying that the note is a stereotypical suicide note, and that it's a suicide note. What I believe and what they presented are two different things, and I get them confused sometimes.
Yeah.
I believe that what they presented was me saying that it's not a suicide note, that it was just stereotypical language, and that anyone could have written. But actually, I ran the note three ways through my software that I've developed for identifying suicide notes.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com. How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger. Feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So that software is called SNARE, for suicide note assessment research. And also because I do think that suicide is a real snare in human life. All right, so SNARE works by looking for the linguistic patterns that are associated with suicide notes and also with a bunch of control documents. So sometimes suicide notes sound like love letters. Sometimes they sound like apologies or business letters even. And they can also be like trauma narratives. I mean, that's one of the reasons they're so hard to identify, is because they're all over the place. You know, they're not stereotypical the way we normal people, you know, think they should be. Yeah. So we go through the text analysis that is done by computer, and it finds these patterns and then counts them up. And then we apply a statistical procedure to it, and it tests, is this on the side of real suicide notes, or is it on the side of the control documents, like love letters, apologies, business letters, trauma narratives, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And that software is about 86% accurate when the notes are real short, like 45 words or less, and it's about 81% accurate when the notes are very long, which makes sense when you think about it, because the longer the note, the more it can become like one of the control documents, you know, like the more it becomes a trauma narrative or the more it becomes a big, long apology. But the real short ones don't seem to have that room, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I ran the Cobain note, the whole note, the whole page, okay, and that came out as a real suicide note. Then I ran the top three quarters of it, which everybody seems to notice about the note, that there's like a division between mm-hmm. the top three quarters and the bottom quarter.
Right.
So the top three quarters came out as a suicide note, and then the bottom quarter came out as a suicide note.
What?
So yeah. He wrote them at two different times, do you think? Or?
You know, I thought about this, and yeah. I actually said this while I was being, you know, filmed for the Soaked in Bleach, but I think that this was cut. He wrote a very poetic first suicide note, the first part of it, you know, where he talked about his career, his love of music, but his real disgust and hatred of the music industry, his feeling that he wasn't being fair to his fans because he really hated what his life was like, his inability to cope with it well. And then he wrote a more stereotypical suicide note at the bottom. Well, when you think about it, he killed himself twice, too. He overdosed himself, and then he shot himself. So his suicide note is very much like a metaphor.
Yeah, it's indicative of how he did it.
Yes. Yes. He's, you know, we have to remember he was a poet.
Well, yeah, he was a songwriter.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, I have to agree with Al. Let's take this just a step further. Do you think that it's possible, then, that maybe previous to his actual death, maybe he was considering suicide, wrote that portion of the letter, then thought secondly about it, and, well, let's put this away. I'm not quite ready to do this, like we were just discussing. You know, people are sometimes indecisive about it. And then, you know, he's like, you know what? What the heck? I'm tired. I'm going to do it. And wrote the second portion. I mean, why let a letter go to waste? And I'm not saying that to be funny, but, you know, it would almost be poetic. And so he wrote the second half when he actually did it.
And that to me, I haven't heard anything ever against that theory. In fact, you're the first person I've ever heard actually propose that theory. I wouldn't know. I think the only way anybody could have tested that would have been like ink analysis of the two different sections. And I don't even know who has the original document anymore. But, I mean, that could have been one way to do it, to say, okay, was the ink from the first section older than the ink in the second section? Or was it a different pen, even, you know, a different source? I have no idea. That's a really interesting, great theory to me.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're trying to present that Courtney Love wrote the note, and she copied his writing in the film.
Yes.
And I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't believe it. Plus, you know, we have another another expert who was in the film, and that's Heidi Harrelson, and she's a forensic document examiner. Now, she's saying the same thing, that they had cut what she did in the interview to make it sound like she said it was traced by Courtney and written by someone else, but that's not what she really said. She said it was mischaracterized through the editing and taken totally out of context.
Yes, I was really surprised that so many of us had the same experience with the Soaked in Bleach editing. I knew that about Heidi. I know her. And I knew that about another person in the film. And when I look back on it, you know, it was pretty obvious to me that there was a struggle going on, you know, among the directors or producers, I'm not sure who was who, where they would ask questions in one way, but then talk in another way off camera. And, you know, I was just told to say what I had done, and that's what I did. You know, I talked about Snare and how it's been validated on 400 suicide notes, and so we know the error rate. Now, obviously, Snare's got a pretty good error rate, you know, from 14 to 20%.
Yeah.
And that's not bad.
It's not bad, but, I mean, it's not, you know, 5% error rate. But, I mean, they're really hard to do. And, frankly, the fact that we expect police officers to do it is astounding to me, when psychiatrists can only identify notes between 50 and 70% of the time. Yeah. But typical, we have this attitude that police officers have to do everything and be everything. to everybody at all times, you know. And I mean, I just, one of the reasons I built this tool, when I got work, when I got started in this field, I realized, wow, you know, I could build tools that would give cops really good, reliable things to use, and they wouldn't have to just, you know, kind of go by their gut or hope they got it right, or,
yeah,
you know, they could have just some...
I would appreciate it. I'm chuckling because I am in law enforcement, so we could certainly use it.
Yeah. Oh, special.
Yeah,
camera.
I know. It's like we expect cops to be, you know, mental health counselors at all times too, and that goes to this whole thing of suicide. You know, we really expect them to be able to read something or talk to somebody and just accurately assess a person's mental state.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have psychiatrists who struggle to do this after all of their years of training on just this one thing.
Now, speaking of that, let me shift gears here, because Al and I were discussing this off air before we brought you on. How often do you run? Okay, let's say we have a suicide note. Well, let's just go to Kurt Cobain, and we have a suicide note. And everybody, I myself, I was a pretty good fan of Kurt Cobain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's dead. We have a suicide note, yet we have a wife who is in the same industry, and we're talking about Courtney here,
mm-hmm.
and she's not very well liked. I mean, let's just be intellectually honest here.
Right.
So how often do you run into the fact that we automatically assume that she must have done it, not for any good reason, but just simply because of public dislike for her?
I think that in many of these cases, the conclusion is politically motivated. And I'm going to use that term politically in like a really broad sense.
Sure, I understand.
What I mean is that there's all kinds of other reasons that make a decision, it is suicide or it's not suicide, the favored one. And, I mean, I had a case with a very high-ranking military officer, and he had been involved in some pretty high-profile missions in the Middle East. It was concluded by, you know, a military investigation that he committed suicide based, and part of the argument there was the last email that he sent to his wife. His wife contacted me, and, you know, I ran the note through Snare, and it was not a suicide note.
Uh-oh.
I wrote my analysis up, and, you know, the military was not interested in hearing from me.
The hell you say.
Pardon?
I said, the hell you say.
Yes. And it was because the thought of this guy being murdered was just too hot. A political issue, you know, given where he was stationed at the time, what that said about air base security, what it would say about infiltration, you know, it was just easier, in my opinion, it was just easier for the military to say, hey, this is a suicide. And of course, a Marine would shoot himself with his wrong hand in the head.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, I found that out after I did the analysis, you know, and his wife said to me, he would never use his wrong hand for shooting.
Yeah, we have got the most, you know, I also am in the military, National Guard at this point. I'm trying to retire. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have got the most weapons training in the world, but we're going to use our wrong hand.
Yes, to do something like shoot ourselves in the head. You know, but see, no gun residue testing was done on him. Nothing. It was a really, really incomplete, very incomplete crime scene investigation. But I do think it goes back to what you're saying, is that sometimes there's such a popular attitude of what it should have been, that it's easy, to just not be thorough.
Or you just automatically, you just sink your teeth into a suspect and you just won't let it go. Because in preparation for this interview, I was mentioning to some of my friends at work, you know, hey, I'm going to be talking, you know, blah, 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 Kurt Cobain, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, yeah, that Courtney Love. Yeah, she, you know, she did it. Oh, it, you know, she wrote that note. Ah, you know, how do you know that? Well, she just did.
Yes. Well, yeah, so see, one of the things I've always been interested in doing that I've never had the opportunity to do on this case was just to compare the authorship of the note. Like, going back to the first thing I talked about, the syntactic analysis of authorship, I don't have any of Kurt Cobain's other writings. I don't have any of Courtney Love's writings. But it would be really fascinating if I had that, if I had enough, I need about 2,000 words or 100 sentences for each of the suspects, and it would be really interesting to see if we can differentiate Courtney Love and Kurt Cobain's known writings, and then try to classify the note to one of them as an author.
So you need a control sample.
I would have to have the known writing samples from him and known writing samples from her, right?
Well, I can ask her.
Sure. There you go.
Oh, boy. Boy, are we fixing to open a can of worms.
Yeah, I am. I love Courtney.
I mean, that would really, to me, that would really be a way of, you know, if people are claiming that she wrote it, then let's test if she wrote it.
Exactly.
You know, and I do have a method that gets into court and that, you know, has a high accuracy rate. And it would really be interesting to see, okay, well, we wanted to know, did she write it or not? Did he write it or not?
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm starting to get the feeling that a lot of the people that want him to have committed suicide, or want him to have been killed instead of committed suicide, they don't want to go that far because I don't think they really believe it, tell you the truth.
Nobody has ever said to me, like what you just said, you know, like, yeah. Well, we'll ask her for writing samples. Nobody's ever said that to me. You know, they just kind of clamp down.
Right, because we don't really want to know. Because especially the producers of that film, you know, we're going to go through 10 people that were on it, and every single one of them said that it was taken out of context, and they've totally changed it for one direction. It's like saying, this is the answer, she murdered him, and that's it. And they only presented evidence that would fit that and changed people's words. And
yes.
And that is either just to do it to sell and to get some notoriety, or either they really believe it. But I really don't think they believed it, because you wouldn't have to change it if you believed it.
Well, it's just to maintain the popular opinion.
Yeah, and that's right. Jumping on the bandwagon, and that's got to be stopped. That's my opinion, but you know.
So, do you think it's a? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I mean, to me, it's really an honor to be on your show and to be allowed to speak freely about it, because I obviously did feel that my words were twisted or, you know, spliced. Or I do remember saying that the last portion of the note was more what we non-suicidal people think of as what should be a stereotypical suicide note. But that doesn't mean that the top part isn't a suicide note.
Right.
Because suicide notes are all over the place.
Yeah.
And that's the part, they just took out that one little part about, about stereotypicality, and took away, you know, as far as I can tell from what people have said to me, you know, the rest of my opinion was not there. And so, you know, thank you very much for giving me this chance.
Yeah, because when I was approached by a source who told me about some of this, and then that's when I started going through the film and taking everyone's name and then started searching them out. And we're going to have quite a few of them on. And it's I just want them to be able to say, hey, this is what really happened. I'm tired of all this fake news.
You know,
I started saying,
high
level.
It really is fake news, and this happened long before fake news became real news. You know, I mean, this was a couple of years ago,
and
I remember thinking, I was just so, it took them a very long time to actually get a distributor for the film, and you know, every once in a while I would just email and say, hey, how are things going, you know, and they would say, oh, we're going fine, we're still looking for this, or doing this, or whatever. And we'll let you know. And then it came out, and nobody let me know.
Yeah.
It wasn't until somebody called me that I said, oops,
yeah.
I guess it's out now.
Yeah. You know, it always worries me when I spoke to the director and then even Tom Grant, the investigator, and it always makes me turn my head. When Tom Grant replied, he said he'd only do the show if he was being paid for the show.
Oh, wow.
And so that to
is
me,
it?
Yeah, that's like, no, yeah. I'm not paying you if you don't want to defend your work. And,
yeah, isn't the truth more important than money?
Well,
absolutely.
In his case, obviously not. And that taints it for me. As soon as someone starts asking for money to give you information or to talk about their work, because he's behind
right.
it all. He's the one that said Courtney
right.
contacted him, blah, blah, blah. And I understand that. But it's time to tell the truth and to come out. And
yeah.
And that made me think second right there. And but, you know, and I'm a fan in the sense that I like Kurt Cobain, his work. Didn't know him. And it's sad if he committed suicide. Sad, it's terrible if he got murdered. But I was more on the being murdered side before, but I'm certainly more on the suicide now.
Really, you know, it also is interesting that so many different types of analysis would be converging when I work cases. Sometimes the documents I deal with have some handwriting on them. Other times the issue is digital evidence, like what hard drive did it come off of? You know, can we find anything about, you know, an IP address that it might have come through when it was getting emailed, that kind of stuff. And so to me it's like a three-legged stool. I don't want to know what the other people have come up with. I want to work independently from them and then allow the investigator at the end of it to look over the whole thing and say, okay, you know, are we all heading in one direction? Are we completely, you know, are all the different types of analysis confused and, you know,
yeah. Well,
because that really gives the investigator something to work with.
Right. Yeah. And the big thing is we do want the truth. At the end of the day, it may not be what we like. It might not be the way we want it to be, but
right.
the bottom line is we want to know what really happened. And
yes.
And that's sort of what my goal was for this series of shows. Being in Seattle, I just want to bring out the people and let's really say what they think and put it together from that evidence. I don't want to have a frame of what I think happened and try to make and take the evidence that fits that. You know,
right.
afterwards, I want to just get all the evidence and kind of go, well, this is the way it looks, and leave it at that.
That's quite, yeah. And that's exactly why having a really objective, really, you know, the reason I put my method into software is so that it's not me or one of my helpers figuring it out on our own little subjective selves.
Right.
Yes.
The machine has no skin in the game. doesn't know anybody, doesn't have a theory, doesn't even know the music we're talking about. You know, just it's just looking for linguistic patterns. Oh, and I think that really helps the law enforcement community, you know, because they don't have to worry if I was corrupted with confirmation bias, it's now a popular term. You know, was I looking to find something because I was already primed to look that way?
Right.
It's really crucial to have objective and statistical analysis. You know, like, hey, the statistical model says it's more likely one way than the other. You know, and I can't rig the numbers. They are what they are.
Right. Like we were saying early on in the interview, when it comes to a jury, everything has got to be so cut and dried. But if I can amend what you're saying, these are people who were celebrities, and we latch on to these celebrities. They mean so much to us. Music means so much to us. It becomes such a part of our being. Like, I listen to a lot of talk radio, and through that, I feel like I've really made a bond with these people. And it's just hard for me to wrap my mind when one of them dies and we, you know, it's said that they have committed suicide. How could they possibly have killed themselves? I'm a part of this man. You know, how dare he do this? No, it's got to be something else. She has had to have killed him. And I'm now completely, you know, unreliable as a witness because of my bond that has been created.
Yeah, you are.
That is such a great way to describe it. You're right. I mean, that's what happens to experts, too. You know, I mean, experts can become so friendly with the attorneys they're working for or so sympathetic to the side that they're hired by. You know, and I give talks about this all the time. The only way to protect ourselves as experts and to protect the criminal justice system is to have methods that just are completely objective, computerize them as much as you can, get away from, you know, one person's interpretation of the data, because otherwise we're all just prone to that.
Again, this has been a fascinating hour. I've really enjoyed it. Our guest has been Dr. Carol Chasky. And thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much. Great conversation with you two. Really appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.